B. Just one second, please, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Nick Norris. I represent Ms. Donaldson. We are seeking this court to reverse the trial court's order granting summary judgment dismissing Ms. Donaldson's sexual harassment and retaliation claim. One of the first areas that I want to cover is the sexual hostile work environment claim and the issue of severe pervasiveness. The court determined that Ms. Donaldson's harassment that she claims she has suffered was not severe or pervasive enough. The problem with the court's analysis is while it does cite the correct legal standard, whether it be severe or pervasive, the only cases it refers to as examples as to whether something is severe or pervasive enough uses the wrong standard. It uses a severe and pervasiveness standards that this court in the Harville case has reversed and says were not the correct standards.
Did I write Harville?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
Pat myself on the back.
Another issue that became with this court is there were numerous comments that were made that were not specifically directed towards Ms. Donaldson, but she witnessed on numerous occasions. The court determined that these allegations could not be severe enough, it could not affect someone's employment. And we have cited Fifth Circuit precedent, Rogers v. EEOC, where it dealt with a racial hostile work environment claim where there were comments directed towards other individuals, not specifically to the plaintiff, and said that that was good enough. And that while the Rogers case was based on race, there's no reason that it cannot be based on sex as well.
As I understand it, Ms. Donaldson worked for Popeyes for what, about 18 months?
Correct, Your Honor.
And during that 18 months, do you have an estimate of how many of these extremely inappropriate, going way beyond boorish, outrageous comments were made?
Your Honor, I believe they were made essentially on a daily basis.
I've only read about five in the brief. That's my question. I didn't see that, you know, he repeatedly said this or he repeatedly said that. If it's going to be severe or pervasive,
right?
Pervasive means it's got to happen with some frequency, and that's my question. So over this course of about 18 months, how many of these instances have you documented?
We have documented the action, issues with her bra, the issues with being bad built, Mr. McLaurin referring to his penis as Georgia Pacific logs, referring to some juice being spilt regarding to another female employee, her water being broke, with regard to flies being in the...
Right. We got that one. That's six.
Right. And I believe...
Code red, seven.
The code red is seven, and the code red is not something that just happened once. What we've alleged is this happened on a normal basis. It did not say that it happened on a daily basis.
And the Speedy, that's eight. Speedy
correct.
Oil, so that's about eight. So of those eight or nine, how many happened frequently?
Okay. The code reds would have happened frequently.
Would have or did?
Did.
And so there, we're going to find something in this summary judgment record where she says, code red was hollered every other day or every day or something.
I don't know if she specifically says every other day or daily, but she does specify that it happened more than once. I do not think she said it was daily. Another issue was the Georgia Pacific log trucks. She does not specifically say it happened daily, but does say that Mr. McLaurin mentioned it on numerous occasions while she was employed there. And one thing with the severe pervasiveness issue, I think many times courts look just where it's severe enough or whether it's pervasive enough, and I think really it's more of a sliding scale to where you have one issue that one thing could be severe enough or where it may not be severe enough on the pervasive, it might take 10, but then you've got somewhere in the middle ground, I apologize, somewhere in the middle ground where that has a sliding scale where I don't think this would necessarily be much like the Furpala case when it happened on a specific daily basis, but would be somewhere in that middle ground.
In addition to these egregious statements, is part of the record supporting your work environment also that people allege that the decision makers and supervisors were picking people to move up in the company based upon their extracurricular goings on with their superiors?
Yes.
And doesn't that also form a basis of your hostile work environment, that if there's a known, if it's known in the company that this is how you get ahead, and that's what's being communicated and discussed, and that's the context of all these outrageous, that's also part of the factor?
That is correct, Your Honor. That happened at the very beginning on two separate occasions, one with Mr. McLaurin, one with Mr. Williams. And another thing that is...
Well, tell us what happened, because as I understood it, McLaurin perhaps said to her, well, Joe, somebody is recommending you to go to assistant manager school, and I'm going to be mighty upset if I hear it's because people are sleeping with Mr. Williams or someone else. I mean, was that directed at her, other than the fact that it was an inappropriate comment?
Yes, I believe it was clearly directed to her, because what it assumed was is that when a woman got a promotion, that she had to be sleeping with management to get that. And I think that is not necessarily a comment that would be so severe for one instance to be a hostile work environment, but goes more towards the totality of the hostile work environment. Another thing I did not mention.
He did that twice?
I'm sorry, it only occurred once. I apologize. It was regarding the two managers. It only happened once at the very beginning.
But didn't something else, one of the coworkers, say something of the same sort at another time of a promotion or?
Yes, another employee had mentioned that's the only way you get employed, that you do that is if you snitch or if you sleep with management.
But an employee said that.
Correct. That was an employee that said.
Suggesting that's part of a severe or pervasive hostile work environment?
Yes, Your Honor, it can be.
For an employee to say that to another employee?
I believe it can be if that is reported. I believe that co-employee harassment can exist and can be if it's reported to management. They follow that procedure when one employee is harassing the other, and the employee that is being harassed complains and says, this co-employee is harassing me.
Did she make that claim to management?
No, she did not make that specific claim to management.
Because when I read the brief, I just took that to be that this was a friendly comment by a co-employee that you can't get ahead in this company.
Right.
Unless you do one or the other.
Right. I think that was, that may have been what was in, what the employee that said it may have inferred, but I believe Ms. Donaldson took it in another way, where she took it where that's the only way you could get a promotion.
Is that what she said in her deposition or affidavit?
I don't believe it was specifically referred to, Your Honor, whether she specifically said that or not. I would have to go back and look at the record. One other instance regarding the hostile work environment that I did not mention was the fact that management referred to Ms. Donaldson as stupid. And while this comment in itself or ignorant or numerous other things that seem to infer that she lacked intelligence, while this may not have a sexual inference in the wording in itself, in the totality of the circumstance, looking at the code reds and how women were treated, I believe that these comments should have been considered as well as part of the hostile work environment.
Should we also consider that female employees were the only employees ordered to go to meetings about lack of productivity and that sort of thing?
Correct, Your Honor. That is one issue with it's also part of the retaliation claim as well as the hostile work environment
claim.
This
is the one instance?
Is it just one meeting?
This was one meeting that they had Ms. Donaldson type out the memo for. And this is really a place where the defendant has been, or the appellee has been, really inconsistent, because they told Ms. Donaldson this meeting was being held because they had failed an inspection. And when they got there, there was no talk of inspection. It was really more of an ambush.
But was it explicitly just for female employees?
Correct.
I mean, that is explicit on its face.
It was explicit for female employees. And when the defendant was asked about it, it gave a different explanation to the EEOC and said that we had heard Ms. Donaldson was trying to get witnesses to sign statements against the EEOC, and they were worried about that hurting employee morale. And I assume they thought that this meeting, this harassment meeting, was there to stop her from part going through this investigation and getting the EEOC statements to support her contention. And as we put into our brief, into our trial court, was another employee, Kiwi Jordan, who had potentially either had filed a charge or was looking at filing a charge from how the EEOC denoted her as PCP as a possible charging party, went back and changed her mind right before this meeting and attacked Ms. Donaldson during this meeting and either withdrew her charge or decided not to pursue it. That in itself, we believe, is part of the hostile work environment, but also part of the retaliation claim to go towards a constructive discharge.
Is there any evidence in the record that when this all unfolded and the coworker starts allegedly attacking the person at the meeting, that the supervisors at the meeting said, hey, wait a minute, we shouldn't be discussing this at all, and we'll let that play out through the proper channels, but let's keep this on the issues that we have today before us, or try to bring it back to appropriate types of discussions?
No. In fact, when management, further on in the meeting, management specifically told Ms. Donaldson, you're the devil, and I'm the reason you've got that red shirt on. And that red shirt is referring to a management shirt.
Management being McLaurin.
Correct. And the same sexual harassment that they've got overlooking this meeting. And this is also with the fact where the defendant has claimed that it has an affirmative defense where it took reasonable steps. It took no reasonable steps.
Well, before you get to that,
okay.
The notice of this meeting, and it was on a Saturday morning?
I believe so, Your Honor.
The notice said, we're holding a meeting to discuss the poor performance on the most recent national Popeye's Fried Chicken inspection or something along that line?
Correct.
And was one sent to each, supposedly one sent to each employee, but in fact only one sent to each female employee?
I believe there was a notice that Ms. Donaldson did, and it was, I don't remember if it was sent specific to each female employee or if there was just a notice put up.
A posted notice. Did it say all female employees or all employees?
It said all female employees.
All right. And they are the ones that were at the meeting?
Correct.
So the notice said that from the get-go.
Correct.
Mrs. Donaldson wasn't surprised when she got there to find only women were there. She knew that from the notice that she herself had typed.
Correct.
All right.
With regard to the affirmative defense, the defendant has essentially tried to adopt the EEOC investigation. It did no investigation. It claims that it took reasonable steps by having Mr. McLaurin verbally reprimanded. The problem with that is that Popeye's specific policy says even verbal reprimands are written down and recorded somewhere. We asked in discovery for all relevant evidence. There's no record sent out that Mr. McLaurin was ever given a verbal reprimand. This disputes clearly that they took any action.
Isn't the amount of time it's disputed? You claim we all know that she went to the EEO first, and they told her, well, you need to go complain first to your employer. So she went back.
Correct.
You say that she didn't renew her EEOC claim until 8 days later, I think, and they say she renewed it in 3 days or something. And so there's this dispute over when notice was received. But
correct. There's
under either standard, that's not a whole lot of time allowed for an investigation of serious charges of this type.
Well, I think what you have to look at, Your Honor, is that they took no action here. And
they claim they hired a lawyer.
After they got the EEOC charge.
But did they try to separate them in any way?
No, we have no evidence.
Without saying it's your fault or your fault or you're lying or not, but let's separate you two while this is being investigated, as would ordinarily be the course in this type of investigation.
Right, and I can understand if the employer said we didn't have time to fully investigate it and want to continue investigating it, why the EEOC did, but they did not. Here, they just tried to rely on the EEOC's investigation, and in fact, as part of the EEOC process, they tried to reconciliate the two parties, and they did here, and tried to make an offer to split them up, to put her at a different store and send him to harassment training just to cover the basis, and they refused.
Who is they?
I apologize. Popeye's refused. The respondent refused to the EEOC to separate the two.
But that's totally different from whether or not she followed internal company procedures and gave the company a chance to rectify this under the Farragher line of cases.
I understand the issue with that, but the problem is the mere fact that she filed a charge did not prevent them from doing anything. When she filed a charge, they had the ability. As an employment lawyer, I represent many employees. I see many EEOC investigations with the employer.
We just assume you're the greatest employment lawyer on earth, but that's totally irrelevant to what you're saying right now.
There's nothing that prevented them from furthering their investigation. They can't cite to anything.
I'm sorry, I need to get this out, though. What is the evidence of the alleged threat of criminal prosecution and the bonus withholding in the record? That's constructive discharge, but is there any evidence in the record of that? You just say that in your brief.
We will have to concede that with the withholding of the bonuses, that is not specifically, there's no record evidence put to that. Now, with the, I apologize, what was it? The
criminal prosecution.
The criminal prosecution, that is in the record. That was in the deposition and mentioned in the
deposition. Can you cite me specifically? No?
Not in front of me, but I can try and do that. Thank you.
Well, try to have that by the time you come back for rebuttal. All right, Mr. Hanbury for CDB.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Hanbury. I represent the Appalee CDB.
Before you begin, Mr. Hanbury, why did you spend three or four pages in your brief telling us about all of the terrible things that had happened in Ms. Donaldson's background, like problems with her children or problems with her marriage or this, that, and the other? What relevance does that have to
It's relevant, to this? Your Honor, because we believe that a major source of this complaint is due to that background, and particularly the psychological issues, and that was borne out in what was going to be the medical proof had we gone forward in the case.
Well, is that in the summary judgment record?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And did you present that to the district court as this is pretext?
Yes, sir. It was in there. We alleged that this was more, not so much pretext, because that comes into the kind of
right.
the employer
You're
side.
Saying this
exaggeration,
is what was the real basis for the problem.
Oversensitivity, exaggeration, and, really hypersensitivity.
How on a summary judgment can a district judge be deciding about oversensitivity?
Because the court is weighing whether the conduct in this point rises to the level of being either severe or pervasive, and we'll talk about that in a minute, then it's supposed to consider an objective standard. So by that definition, no. But the plaintiff was taking a subjective approach. So we were trying to counterbalance that subjective approach that was being taken by the plaintiff in this case,
as opposed to the objective standard. I didn't mean to interrupt you, sir.
No, that's fine.
I'm a little bit confused. Oversensitivity is why she would be offended by these comments? Or she's somehow fragile or
right.
crazy or something? And
no,
that's why
not
you
crazy,
think that,
but
are you saying these aren't a reasonable person wouldn't find these highly offensive?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're saying that a reasonable person would not find highly offensive the record evidence of the comments by this man, McLaurin?
No, I'm saying, assuming that assuming these statements were made, I'm not saying that a reasonable
Does
person...
Does he deny making them?
Most of them, yes, sir. That's why we, in our motion, we just assumed, almost like a 12B6 motion, we assumed her facts as true. Now, someone might find these offensive, but the question is whether or not, to the objective person, it rises to the level of being severe or pervasive enough to constitute a hostile work environment. I believe the district court called some of these comments boorish, and I would concur with that if they were made. They are. Whether they were made or not, they are. But that's not the question as to whether or not it's crass or boorish. The question is, and the issue addressed by the district court, was whether this conduct, assuming all these statements were made, rises to the level of being severe or pervasive enough to constitute a hostile work environment or an abusive work environment. Now, the appellants say the court didn't even consider whether it was pervasive, only hostile, severe. They must have been reading a different opinion because, quoting the court found, this court does not believe the conduct is severe or pervasive enough to support a hostile work environment claim. We agree that the test is in the disjunctive, but both were considered by the court and rejected by the court. They also claimed that, the district court was in error because he didn't consider in his judgment these comments made to other parties. Now, of the eight or so comments that are referenced, by and large, virtually all of them were made to others or to no particular person in general. Not only did the judge consider that, and he found it is difficult to see how McLaurin's comments directed at other individual employees affected the terms and conditions of her employment, but the plaintiff herself admitted in her deposition that these complaints directed at others did not particularly bother her and did not affect her work performance.
Do you have a cite for that?
I cited in the brief to the record. This is...
She specifically said, oh, this which was done to other people didn't affect me or my work.
Right. To the best of my recollection, I asked her, now, these comments that were made to other parties, did that bother you? And she said, not particularly. And did it in any way interfere with your ability to perform your work? And she said no. And I don't have the cite right here, but it is in the brief to the record. The hard part about these cases in looking at it and determining whether or not the particular complained of conduct rises to the level of being severe and persuasive is that there is no hard and set rule. But when you look at the cases like Slay, Hockman, and Shepard from this court, where this court has found as a matter of law that the conduct did not rise to the level of a hostile work environment, and you compare it to the conduct alleged here, there's a vast difference. The conduct in those cases was far worse than what is alleged in this case, and yet the court held that it did not rise to the level of a hostile work environment. And particularly in Slay and Septimus, this court said that the finding of a sexually hostile work environment is typically reserved for those cases that involve patterns or allegations of extensive, long-lasting, unredressed, and uninhibited sexual threats or conduct that permeated the appellant's work environment. Now, if you look at this case, you have about eight or so comments, assuming they were made at all, that occurred over a period of a year and a half, most of which were not directed at the plaintiff, and most of which, therefore, she said, did not bother her and did not affect her work performance. It can hardly be said that this is some highly charged atmosphere that permeated the work environment.
Could a fact finder construe the alleged comment that you're the devil, you wear the red shirt because of me or something to that effect as a threat, that she wouldn't be wearing that red shirt in the future?
No, because here's why, Justice Elrod. When that comment was made in a meeting, you got to remember, Mr. McLaurin is the one that recommended her for the promotion.
Right, but isn't he saying, I recommended you for the promotion, and I can take it away at any time, and you wouldn't even be wearing that red shirt if it wasn't for me, and so you better not be saying that. Could a reasonable fact finder think of it like that?
Not, well, if you take it out of context and consider it by itself, but you have to consider the context. Mr. McLaurin made that statement because he had been helping her cope with her grandmother's death. He had recommended her for the management job. These people talked on the phone all the time. And here, this meeting that they had, and everybody terms it the attack meeting, well, it was Mr. McLaurin who was attacked in the meeting by the plaintiff's coworker. Nobody had brought up this whole case. The plaintiff's coworker, who the appellant had tried to get to sign papers and so forth, was the one that brought this whole thing up. And Mr. McLaurin did say, I've interpreted it as meaning you should be grateful instead of hating me, that if it weren't for me, you wouldn't be wearing that red shirt. Now, much has been said about whether or not the plaintiff met the Ellis-Farragher defense. And we're accused of not getting an investigation done in 3 days, 4 days, or 8 days. The record shows that she went to the EEOC first. She had no intention of pursuing the avenues that were available to her with the company. And we had a sexual harassment policy with a bypass procedure. She never intended to comply. She went to the EEOC. And, of course, they told her that she had to use this internal procedure. So she goes on the 18th of September and tells Mr. Chun's secretary about the complaint. The 21st, she signs her EEOC complaint. That's 3 days later, and we receive it on the 22nd in the mail. 4 days that we were, on the one hand, supposed to have completed an investigation, but then on the other hand, they argue that we should have continued the investigation pending the EEOC charge, which the record clearly established that we did. The outside counsel retained by CDB had multiple items of correspondence with the EEOC throughout this investigation, both internal and the EEOC investigation. So it didn't, things just didn't come to a screeching halt the day we got the EEOC notice. The investigation, in fact, had not even started then because they had to retain outside counsel. The investigation went on. Witnesses were interviewed. The one thing that we had to be careful about, that CDB had to be careful about, is in dealing with the complainant and not, you went out of their way to make it not look like there was any retaliation or any attempt to coerce or retaliate against her. The only thing that they have cited to support this retaliation claim is the famous November 11th meeting and the two meetings where she was counseled about her employment, her performance. Now, in this regard, we've got to remember that in order to support a retaliation claim, the appellant must show a tangible employment action that is a significant change in employment status, such as hiring, firing, failing to promote, reassignment with different responsibilities, or a significant change in benefits. None of that happened. Now, I will concede the record is not clear about this.
Are you talking about retaliation now?
Yes, sir.
And a tangible employment?
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the Supreme Court in Farragut uses the term tangible employment, but in retaliation, it's an adverse employment action. And under its Burlington case, those are two very different standards. Burlington doesn't say it has to be some absolute decision. It just has to be something that would cause a reasonable person not to want to engage in protected activity.
I know, and I guess that caused you some consternation about the Matern case.
Didn't cause me any consternation, counsel.
But I agree.
Made Judge Dennis happy, but it didn't cause me any consternation.
I agree with you, but it's hard for me to justify. And so what I'm doing here is taking the stricter standard. And even if we employ the stricter standard, or a broader standard, actually, that would allow a broader definition of a tangible employment action.
Well, just call it an adverse employment action. That's what's used in the test.
All right. I will. Either way, we don't meet that standard. We had the meeting of November 11th. Now, the record to me is not clear whether that meeting was called for only female employees or all employees. It was called for the purpose of discussing two failed evaluations. Now, the meeting began with this claim not
were
even
were only in. Female employees there?
I believe that's the case, Your Honor.
Well, what does the record show?
The record is not clear at all about that. I cannot make a representation to you one way or the other because the record to me is not very clear.
Only female employees and one manager that's male. Is that right?
I think.
So one, there is a male there. It's the
correct.
Manager
that's correct.
One at issue.
But the key here is that it was not an ambush. The EEOC claim was brought up by a coworker. Who she had solicited to sign affidavits or whatever to support her EEOC claim. The co-worker started out against the appellant.
Now the co-worker is Nikki?
QA Jordan.
All right.
And that's what caused it. And that's what caused it to be brought up. In the other two performance meetings with the plaintiff, it was never discussed. And in fact, the record establishes she was asked if she was happy with her job, and she conceded that she was not developing the respect of her employees. She never brought it up, and the two managers, McLaurin and Maurice Williams, didn't bring it up. The fact of the matter is, she wasn't fired, she wasn't demoted, she wasn't reassigned, there were no change in her benefits. She was merely counseled about her employment performance, which she admitted had some areas of problems. She even asked to take off leave because of a foot injury. She was allowed to do that. No one suggested, her job was held open. No one suggested that she resign. There is just no way that they can point to any tangible employment or adverse employment decision that would constitute the basis of a retaliation claim. So what you have here is a case that over the period of a year and a half, you've got six or eight isolated statements. Boorish, perhaps. Would I allow one of my employees to do that? No. But they're mostly made to third parties, not the plaintiff. The plaintiff admitted most of them did not bother her, nor did they affect her ability to perform her job. And when you compare this case with the Slay case, the Shepherd case, and the Hockman case, where this court has found as a matter of law that the conduct did not rise to the level of a hostile work environment, the only way you can rationalize this case with those is to reach the same decision in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a moment.
Do we still have time?
I would ask, can you go a little bit more over the whether you've established your affirmative defense as a matter of law?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I surely will.
I would like for you to cover that in a little more detail.
The company had in place an anti-harassment policy, and the managers, including the appellant, were trained in employment law. She even took a test on them. The policy, which we've quoted and is in an exhibit, course had requested that you make a complaint to your immediate supervisor, but obviously that wouldn't have worked here, and so, but it had a bypass provision that if your supervisor is the offender or is not getting you results, you go to the owner, which is Mr. Chun, and which is what the plaintiff ultimately did 3 days before filing her EEOC complaint. When we got the EEOC complaint, the company hired an outside attorney, came in, and it was not me, came in, interviewed witnesses, corresponded with the EEOC throughout the claims. We just didn't stop once the EEOC claim was filed. So we clearly, and none of that was ever refuted, so the company clearly took reasonable care to prevent and correct the problem. But just couldn't do so within the plaintiff's mandated 3 or 8 day timeline.
I understand that you didn't have time to complete an investigation in 8 day. I mean, the other lawyer apart from you.
Right.
Didn't have time to do an investigation. But is there any case law that would say that you either would or would not have a duty to at least in the short run try to keep the people apart or not have them going to these meetings and this sort of thing?
I have not seen that, Your Honor. The cases that I've read and that we cited in our brief talks about where the employee goes and files an EEOC complaint but never files a complaint in the internal company procedure.
Right, but you're not saying that the employee unreasonably failed to take advantage of the corrective policy.
Oh,
you're not alleging that.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I am.
You are saying that?
Oh, yes.
But going to the
she never complained to anyone. Even when she did make a complaint way back when, earlier, to Mr. Williams, it was about she and Mr. McLaurin not getting along. She never complained to management at all about this alleged harassment until 3 days before she went to the EEOC.
But you have to win on both prongs to win
correct.
Affirmative defense.
That's correct. Okay. And we've shown, and the district court found, that we took reasonable care to prevent and correct the harassment, and that the employee, the appellant, unreasonably failed to take advantage of it. She was not even going to use the thing until the EEOC people told her that she had to. And then she goes back and jumps through the hoop of making a complaint, and 3 days later goes to the EEOC. Now, and that was after she had already, gone through supposedly months and months of you know, this severe and hostile harassment. Yet she never, ever took advantage of it. She never took advantage of the complaint procedure, even after the EEOC determined not to pursue the charge. She just resigned. She didn't follow up at all on that procedure.
Do you dispute the contention that CDB took no disciplinary action against the supervisors? Do you dispute the contention that CDB didn't take any disciplinary action against the supervisors at all?
No, I do not dispute that, because to take disciplinary action, you would have had to have found that the supervisors did something wrong. And so if you take that, if they, every time a complaint is lodged, the duty is to investigate it and determine the facts to see if someone did something wrong. You're not under any obligation to take disciplinary action if you don't find any wrongdoing.
All right, sir. Thank you. Thank rebuttal, you. Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Your Honor. Real quick, with regard to going to an internal grievance process versus going to the EEOC, this court has said in the Bowes v. Brandstetter case, where that individual resigned and then went to the EEOC, that the it would be reasonable for the person to either or both of, to use either course, through the internal or the EEOC, either or both. They can do one of the two or both, and would be a reasonable action in furtherance. With regard to the EEOC going merely within 3 days,
what was the claim in that case?
It was
a claim of constructive discharge.
It was I believe it was a sexual harassment case, but it was not constructive discharge. What I'm arguing
You're
is
telling us we have a decision by our court post Farragut saying that.
It's a 1990 case.
Well, that's pre-Farragut.
Correct.
It's about 7 years before the Supreme Court changed the law.
I think with this case is a little different, where she went while the harassment was going on during the continuing process, made an internal complaint, and while she did go to the EEOC within 3 days, I believe that punishing her for doing that would be against what the process going to the EEOC is for, and also it is also applying a legal knowledge to Ms. Donaldson that she would not know.
It was in the handbook.
I don't think
What to do.
It was in the handbook for her to file a complaint, but it was not in the handbook that says you have to wait a reasonable time for us to investigate this. And the defendant, you know, says she should have waited a reasonable time. How long is that? Is that a week? A month? 2 months? There's no law on that, and even if there was, it's trying to apply that Ms. Donaldson should know that. Should know. She should have waited two to three months, and by the way, let her 180 deadline just keep on going around, and let the employer, in certain circumstances, lead her to believe that something's going to happen, and let that 180-day deadline go on. With regard to, you asked me...
Suppose she could at least check and see what, if anything, was taking place before filing an EEO complaint within about a week or less.
She could have. She could have gone to the employer and said, are y'all going to take any action on this? And if not, I go to the EEOC. That may have been a very reasonable thing to do. She did not. The employer neither contacted her as well. Once an employee makes that complaint, the employer should have the responsibility to take action, to take reasonable steps to prevent it from occurring again, but also I think to reassure to the plaintiff that we have taken reasonable steps. You don't have to go to the EEOC. We're going to take reasonable steps. They never did that. They never even called her and said, we're going to investigate this or we're doing this. They didn't do anything.
I was puzzled by a phrase you use in your brief at page 34. What do you mean by a quid pro quo sexual harassment through a constructive discharge?
Your Honor, a quid pro quo with regard, from my understanding, a sexual hostile work environment claim really becomes a quid pro quo claim once it is takes an adverse employment action. We've alleged here that the constructive discharge is the adverse employment action that makes the employer automatically liable, where they cannot raise an L defense.
Well, quid pro quo means this for that.
Correct.
And usually we think of it in the terms of if you want to be promoted, you're going to have to engage in sexual activity with me. So how is this quid pro quo?
I don't believe it's so limited to that, Your Honor. I believe in this case where she went against, did not concede to all this sexual harassment in every circumstance, they decided that they were going to force her to resign. The fact that she was supposed to subject herself to this sexual harassment and not make sure that it was unwanted, I believe that is the quid pro quo.
What authority do you have for that rather novel application of quid pro quo sexual harassment?
I don't have it off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I can get it to you by the end of the day.
No, that's all right.
Did you find anything on this alleged threat of criminal prosecution in the record, or you haven't had a chance? You didn't?
I went through. I don't have the record with me. We cited to record page 649. I think it's to our brief, but the problem is that cites to a depo page. I can get you the specific depo page by the end of the day if that's fine.
We can find all of that in the record. I assume it's not that extensive a record.
No.
Anything else?
Real quick.
Your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to mention to both counsel that, and I don't mean this critically, but I'm going to state a fact, that I thought each brief was inadequate in extent of typographical errors, missing pages, this, that, and the other, and I urge you to be a whole lot more careful in the future. Thank you.